let me get going here. Hold tight. This is Richard Barone continuing my oral history interview with Calixto Cabrera for the Vietnam Archives Oral History Project. Today is May 30th, 2006, and Calixto's in Durango. I'm again in Lubbock. And Calixto, we were just talking before we began recording this interview for today about, I asked you about yesterday, Memorial Day, and about, you know, what you did, your activities, and you were discussing the statue you all were working on for your town. Do you want to go ahead and talk about that?
Yeah, it seems that 2.5 years ago, some of the other veterans organizations got together, supposedly it was some kind of a slip-up or something, but did not contact VEVA, which is the Vietnam Era Veterans Association, which encompasses most of the Vietnam veterans in this area, well, not most of them, but a bunch of us Vietnam veterans that live in this area, somehow overlooked VEVA, and VEVA was initially responsible for getting that statue into Veterans Park in Durango back in 1982, and the statue itself already existed because of another Vietnam veteran raised money and put it together. And eventually VEVA became aware of the existence of this statue, petitioned the city told us to put it anywhere we wanted. And we put it in Veterans Park, also known as Iris Park, overlooking the river. It's a real pretty little place. So they decided they were going to create this homogenous thing, did not contact VEVA, and we just found out 2 weeks ago, kind of through one of our members. They supposedly said it was even in the papers, but yet there were like 30 people at our meeting. Nobody was aware of this thing. And it's a small community, so I find it very hard to believe personally. Long story short, they're not moving it because VEVA created a stink. We put the statue there to start off with, and we were not consulted. The city was led to believe that we were on board, and we stopped it. One of the things that came out of this meeting and that I was kind of surprised about was that, first of all, we had about, I don't know, 30 vets show up to the picnic after the memorial, and I didn't know a bunch of them. Some of them had prior histories with VEVA, and some were kind of like newbies showing up. Anyway, we got to talking about the moving of the monument, and we hit consensus E, which was that our statue stays exactly where it is. The other veterans' memorials are welcomed in the park wherever they want to place them, but that we're not moving ours, and that we don't want a grouping of all of the monuments, so that we can do our ceremony on Memorial Day or Veterans Day or whatever. They can do theirs, or they can join ours, or any of our members can join theirs, whatever they want to do, except, you know, no encroachment on our space and no movement of our statue. Part of what came out of it was some of the animosity that I found, myself included, and that these veterans organizations were almost as bad as the general population insofar as greeting the Vietnam veteran coming home. And I'm certainly not talking about all of their organizations, because, you know, some members in their organizations did, you know, reach out to Vietnam veterans and work with them, et cetera, so this is not a general condemnation or a specific condemnation of all these organizations, but it's just a general observation that that these veterans organizations are generally right wing in nature. It's, you know, God and country and patriotism is all high, and they just had a real hard time understanding what's going on with the Vietnam veterans. In return, what happened was that we felt isolated from the general veterans organizations. I mean, I couldn't relate to the things they're talking about, you know, all this gung-ho stuff and going there and kill the commies and this and that, when my reality was something very different. And it turns out that the reality of a lot of Vietnam veterans ended up being very different. We can't relate to these organizations, so we just hung with ourselves. and they in turn don't understand why we're such isolationists. You know, so what came out of the meeting was the animosity that that as a whole the group there was experiencing about how we were treated and greeted by the other veterans organizations, you know, our fellow veterans. It didn't go well, but in the long run, we decided that we didn't want our statue moved, so we could do our ceremony by ourselves if need be. That we in turn weren't going to do the same thing to them that we felt that they did to us was not greet us. We welcomed them into the park, and they can have their monument wherever they want
right.
in the park, and it will be a truly veterans park with a Korean a war memorial, World War II, World War I, and you know God knows how many more, and leaving space for the new memorials that may evolve. But this just whole thing just came out of the clear blue sky, and it's like, wow, mm-hmm. that feeling still runs strong, you know.
Let me ask you this, by including everyone on this memorial, I mean, and you all graciously are saying, yeah, I mean, we're all brothers, we're all veterans, and is this will this provide a bit of healing from their point of view, do you think?
I don't know what it's going to do from their point of view. Right now, they haven't even gotten the word. We're due to have a meeting June 5th. We know that the original organizer of this whole process, who's with VFW, I don't know what the guy's name is, got really upset I was not at the meeting, when Viva members met actually at the park with the city planner and several other members of the city in an informal setup along with members of their the VFW and some of the other veterans organizations. When we started talking about the changes that we wanted, because we hadn't been on board initially or were contacted at all about this whole process, that he started to get really upset, and he said something like, well, fine, you guys want to take this over and redesign the whole thing, well, go ahead. And, you know, I guess fortunately our John I, who's kind of like the informal head of Viva, everything we do is informal, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The informal head of Viva, I guess, was able to talk to him with a little rational process and say, hey, you know, we're not trying to take it over. We just want to have our say in what's developing here, and we don't want some other veterans organizations telling Viva what's going to happen, especially in relationship to this statue. We want our input. We don't want to take it over. We just want our input.
Yeah.
And so he seemed to have calmed down. So now, you know, we're to have this meeting on the 5th, and we're writing kind of like a declaration of purpose to present at this particular meeting with the rest of the veterans organizations. And I volunteered to be in that group because I want to see who these other guys are, and I want to see where we stand, where I stand in relationship to these other veterans.
Yeah, that'd be interesting to find out.
Yeah. How I feel, and because I know that I got a little upset about them telling Viva what's going to happen with our statue. And secondarily, but maybe I should put it in first place, is how I felt about the treatment of Vietnam veterans by other veterans of other wars.
How much does that hurt today for you?
It's painful. It's painful. Listening to that guy say we're going to cry babies as I cry, mm-hmm. I know. What's the difference between the bullets that flew over his head in his foxhole and the bullets that flew over mine? They both had the same intention, to kill either one of us. You know?
Mm-hmm.
We did our tour of duty, and I'm not making any fucking apologies whatsoever for the Vietnam veterans. You know? We did our tour of duty, period.
I'm not really sure that people can understand, especially, say, 50 years from now or 100 years from now when they're listening to this, how the United States could treat a community of veterans this way. No matter what the outcome of the war was, no matter, interpretations of the war by historians, by people after you and I are gone, is there anything that you could say to the people listening to this, decades from now, about the treatment of Vietnam veterans, just kind of in general? What should they understand about this?
First thing they need to understand is we lost the war. This country's not used to losing wars, and we lost the war. Secondly, but more importantly, I don't know what all the particular components that came together politically and socially and blah, 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 but there was a consciousness that developed out of this whole war that America had not undergone. And that consciousness called into question our participation in any wars. The right of the president to send us in some place for some nebulous political agenda. That we wanted to know why we're going to spill blood, why we're going to spill our own blood and spill the blood of others. We want to know why. We want to know clearly why. And it better be some compelling reason, like, the Chinese and the Russians are pouring over our borders. That may be a good reason to go to war. Beyond that, this shit about oil or wood or iron or any minerals or resources, that is dead in this country. Or if it isn't dead, it's heading in that direction. And that consciousness evolved. The veterans that fought in Vietnam embraced that consciousness. We fought for our right to be able to speak our minds and talk about, how we feel about our troops going in anywhere and taking lives and losing lives. But there are also segments of the society that prior to Vietnam find that literally to be treasonous, to question the government, or especially in a time of war, to criticize the government or to criticize the conduct of some of the troops or to criticize some particular body. They literally find it treasonous. And hence it's this schism that exists now between, the Vietnam veterans and the conventional veterans organizations and America as a whole. It's that there are so many people now questioning what the government will do and so many people holding on to the old values about what America is about, and they don't want to see the change. They're very threatened by the change. And they don't really care how many medals we come back from. And I say that as this is their criteria about what valor is all about and this and, and honor. I mean, we talk about honor and valor almost exclusively in reference to major acts of violence committed by this country against other countries and other peoples. That confuses me. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, that's the criteria that they go by. We come back with all of these medals that we've earned doing the dirty work that the government sent us to do. We speak out against it. Guess what? We're as treasonous and as traitorous as any commie or Islamic jihadist or... we're lumped into the same group by this right-wing mentality thing that has such a, a grip on this country. A losing grip, I may add, but that still is pretty strong. And the veterans organizations prior to Vietnam are pretty much uniformly of that mentality. They just, embrace that whole God and flag, America right or wrong, and they're going to do whatever they're going to do. So if, you know, 200 years from now you listen to this and you're confused by the answer, well, welcome to my world.
Yeah. You know? Okay. Shall we go back now into your journey and talk about where you went with this and bring us up to the present?
Okay, one other thing that I wanted to bring up and talk to you about prior to our covering this material. 2 days ago, the other night, I smoked a joint for the first time in roughly 2 years, I think. Mm-hmm. Never have been a big pot smoker, but have always enjoyed smoking pot. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was a really good, clean weed, which may or may not make any sense. I don't know what you've done, and I'm not asking. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if for people who have smoked, this was a real clean, not a heavy burden, some kind of a high that allowed my mind to be fairly clear and thoughtful, but also allowed me to be mobile, you know, didn't zonk my body. Nice weed. Mm-hmm. Anyway, immediately upon feeling the buzz coming on, I got in touch with, and I have many times, it's just that I am reminded again each time I do this, that I kind of consider that a sacred space. Because one of the things that happens to me is when I start getting this weed buzz is I start feeling a connection with life that I don't have in straight state. It's almost like I can feel the vibrance of nature. I can feel the subatomic structure in the building that I'm, you know, in my home that I'm sitting in. And it's just a connection with nature and with life at another level that I just, and I say this with a certain amount of resentment, I cannot seem to attain in straight state. I believe somebody like a Jesus was able to do that in straight state and not need to consume something to attain an altered state for him to get there, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where I want to go, but that's not where I'm at. Anyway, the reason I'm telling you all of this is because one of the realizations, and I kind of started thinking about this this interview that was coming, and I was also working something out with my wife that we had, you know, kind of had a little bit of a falling out. That in that state, I have, like I said, a connection with life that is really different, and an awareness of life and a feeling for life and spirit, because it's all one, that I don't have in straight state, unfortunately. So I was thinking about, and I wanted to, you know, you certainly don't have to answer anytime soon, just think about it for a little while. I was thinking of the possibility of my last interview, which I thought was going to be today, and it may well be. Mm-hmm. But my last interview, doing it in an altered state, kind of like to cap the journey, so to speak.
I think that's fine. It's your call. It's your interview, and what you want to do is your decision. And if that's part of what you need to do, you feel like you need to do, then we're fine with that.
Okay, well, I'm going to think about that one a little while longer, because I can, in my own mind, I can see pros and cons associated with this. So I'll ponder that for a little while.
Okay.
And, you know, I guess we can move on with this thing here.
Well, we're open. I mean, I am, and, you know, the World History Project, we're open to that. This is your personal journey. This is your healing from that war experience. This is where you've come as a veteran. This is where you've come as a person. And if that's relevant to you, it's relevant to this interview.
Okay, well, that sounds good to me. Third healing.
Yes.
Okay, looking at my both my diary and some of my notes and stuff like that, I realized that I have two dates for my third healing. The one I think is accurate was 11/19 of 1994.
Okay.
But I also have a mid-December 1994 third healing reference. I'm almost positive it was that the 19th.
Okay.
This was a process called holotropic breathing. I was in Phoenix, Arizona. And the facilitators of this particular process were a lady named Kit Wilson and David Rush, both of them PhDs. And it's part of a process that they use to help people get in touch with things that are going on in their lives. I don't recall how I even ended up hearing about this. But when I did hear about it, I got interested in it and decided to find out more about it. So I tracked down Kit Wilson,
mm-hmm.
And she said she had an intro tape that they were going to do one, I think, 1 or 2 weeks up the line from when I spoke with her. But it was a requirement to see this video before you go to and actually do it. So I went down and picked up the video and watched it. I think it was the night before I actually went down there to do the holotropic breathing. What the holotropic breathing is, basically, is doing hyperventilation and taking it to a state that I think medical science doesn't think it's possible to attain. The reason I say that was because I remember one time a veteran friend of mine kind of just went a little bonkers, and this other guy who was also a vet, also a friend of mine, came to help him, and he realized that the guy was hyperventilating, and he said, "Here, just like breathe into this bag so you can kind of rebalance carbon dioxide. Get some of that, bring it back more in balance because it's way out of whack."
Mm-hmm.
Well, in holotropic breathing, that's exactly where you want it, is way out of whack. Let me preface this by saying that though I will describe this process, I don't if you have a bad heart condition or bad lung condition or you're in poor health, I do not recommend this process. Definitely go and see and speak to a holotropic breathing facilitator in your area prior to even considering it. But that said, I find it almost impossible to hurt yourself in this process.
Okay.
Physically hurt yourself. However, you do attain an altered state of consciousness while you're in there, and it has a propensity, and the way it was described to me is that it has a way of going into your cellular being and just shaking up and loosening up energies in there that have been clinging on for dear life for who knows how long, and all of a sudden these things start bubbling up to the surface, and you're off and running, so to speak.
Okay.
I watched the tape the night before, and the reaction of the breathers, there's a sitter and a breather. Whoever's doing the breathing and the journey, there's got to be a sitter by them, just kind of like an attendant. And then later on in the afternoon, you switch positions. The breather is now the sitter. The sitter is now the breather. Just to kind of make sure that the person is okay.
Okay.
I watched the tape, and it ran the gamut from people didn't do anything, didn't necessarily experience anything except some very, mild, whatever's slight buzz from the hyperventilation, to people were screaming and crying and carrying on, And I'm looking at this tape and going, oh, this is embarrassing. This is not me. I can't do this. At least, you know, I was referencing these people who were just crying and screaming and doing all of this stuff. It's just like, I'm too cool to do that, you know. I've got to maintain my integrity and blah, blah, blah. You know, I'm too suave of a guy to scream and cry like that. No can do. This is the night before, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I even thought about canceling this whole thing, but I kind of like, you know, I had purchased a space. They knew I was coming. It's part of what they do for their living. And not to mention that, you know, I just thought that this, maybe there's something to here that I need, but it was like all this resistance going, nah, nah, and I focused on all these people screaming and carrying on as my reasons for not wanting to do this. But I overcame that resistance, and the next morning, actually my roommate at the time, a lady named Jadida, told me that I was kind of like antsy and aggressive. Before I left, and anyway, I was supposed to be there at 9 o'clock. I said, okay, well, all right, whatever. So I hit the road. It was about a 20-minute drive from where I lived in Scottsdale. And on the way down, I'm just having all of these kind of thoughts, some of them random, and sometimes I'd lock on, want to stay with it for a while. But prior to that, I had had one thought that I had been pondering and throwing back and forth with myself for a number of years, actually. Not, you know, we're not talking days, weeks, or months. For years, I've been thinking about this question. And that was, because I'd been in the metaphysical movement now for a while, and because I wherever I am, whatever I'm doing, I kind of like my cards on the table. For anyone to know or see, and they either like me or they don't, whatever, you know, that's the way it plays out. I had come to the realization that my openness, in some circles, in some female circles, my openness and my honesty and, quote, sensitivity was attractive to them. And I started to wonder whether I was using this process of sensitivity as a tool of seduction. And I've been wondering about that for years. And so here I am in the car driving down to this holotropic breathing thing. Now I'm not even thinking necessarily about this topic at all, you know, but all of a sudden, you know, just boom, it pops up into my head and I go, oh, that subject. And then I asked myself, well, am I using, you know, this whole sensitivity thing as an instrument of seduction?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer comes slamming in, yes. And I go, oh, fuck. You know, it's just like, that's not higher consciousness. That's, you know, that's still participating in the same old darkness of humanity, so to speak. And so that really bummed me out that I'd finally gotten clarity on this particular answer, on this question rather. And so here I am on my way to Kit Wilson's. Now I'm bummed out, you know, and okay. And that kind of set the stage for, well, at least I didn't know it at the time, but now I know it kind of set the stage for what was going to, about to transpire. So I get down to Kit's house, and they talk about all the rules and regulations and blah, 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 and how the process is going to go. The other thing that I knew just prior to my arrival to Kit's was that I really I wanted the person who was my sitter, I wanted it to be a female and preferably one that I was attracted to. You know, and which kind of brought up the thing, well, that kind of goes along with the answer you just got, you know, you horn dog, you know, and mm-hmm. that kind of thing. But that's what I wanted. And that's that. So when I got down there, there was a lady named Leslie who was really cute. I went and parked next to her so that I could pick her as my partner when they said, okay, people, you know, partner off, which I knew was about to happen. So they did, and I did, and Leslie ended up being my partner. And what I didn't know about Leslie at the time was that, I wasn't dating or seeing anybody, even though my roommate was a woman at the time. Leslie was married with 3 children, and she had, I found out, serious man issues. So I'm not surprised that I ended up, as her, as my partner. And one of the things that she, as a matter of fact, the only thing she really asked me was, she said she also had abandonment issues, and that if I needed to go to the bathroom while she was on her journey, to let her know. Okay.
All right.
Needless to say, that's not quite what happened.
Meaning she wanted to go with you?
No.
Oh, okay.
That she just wanted to be aware of the fact that I was going to be gone for a little while.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, those are pretty serious abandonment issues.
Yeah. So Kit gives us the rules and the regulations. I really wanted to go second anyway. It was a virgin run for me. She had apparently done it before, and she wanted to go first, so that worked out for the two of us. So the stage is set. We're all laid out. First of all, let me say, December or late November in Phoenix, temperature's about 50 degrees, and for Phoenicians, that's pretty damn cold. We're used to really warm weather, and 50 degrees is by God cold. Around here, 50 degrees, I walk around in a t-shirt now.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was really cold weather. Well, we had this thin blanket you lay out on the floor, little pillow, little blanket. Blanket was really small, which is all germane to the story. If I moved much, something popped up or other and let that cold air in, and it was just kind of disruptive to me when it was my turn. But anyway, it was her turn. She's going. She lays out. Now, they had an abundance of music that ran for the entire 2+ hours of each one of our journeys. But for some reason, I still don't know what the criteria is. The music is blaring, just really loud. And it was just like disruptively loud for me. It was really bothersome. And I to this day and to this moment, I eventually found a practical use for the music being that loud. But I'm wondering what it would have been like had there either not been any music, or whether the music was soft, just background music. Anyway, so I'm having a problem with how loud this music is, but Leslie cocoons herself in her blanket, and she starts listening to, and her foot is kind of like moving to the beat of the music, so I can tell that she's kind of enjoying it. Now, the music itself was enjoyable. The only piece of music that I could identify was Kitaro. But it gives you an idea that most of it was either marching music or New Age music. And I found the music itself to be pleasant and enjoyable. I found the volume to be horrible. But that's the way it was. That was the way it was set. So I had to do a lot of clearings and intentions to align to the music to be able to focus and be a little clearer and be in the present, because it was so disruptive to me. So she starts her breathing, and the other thing I came to the realization about this lady named Leslie was that while as part of our instructions, it was that with the person's permission, it was okay to lay your hands on them every now and then. I knew that this was a don't touch unless she requests it type of thing. So I was just going to basically just sit there, which is what I did, and which transpired. What transpired? But somewhere along the line, I had to take a pee really bad.
Right.
This was an hour and a half into the process, so I flagged Kit to come over here and sit with Leslie while I go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. I just didn't feel like it was appropriate to disturb Leslie, just to let her know that I'm going to take a pee.
Right.
So I go, take a pee, I come back, Leslie's gone. She's not there. The one thing she had asked of me is don't leave, let me know if you got to go to the bathroom type of thing. Well, she had to go to the bathroom. And so, you know, gee, well, you know, we never did talk about it, but it's like, you know, the one thing she asked me not to do is exactly what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that did with her trust issues, but, and the other, you know, the one more thing in reference to Leslie, one of the things I found was that when she was cocooned, before she covered her head, initially her head was not covered. She was just kind of cocooned, all cozy-like in that blanket and whatnot, laying there. I felt like a lawyer, kind of just like looking at her and peeping in. And it dawned on me how intimate an act it was, kind of like to be cozied up and ready to go to sleep, or just be cozied up and cuddled and blah, blah, blah. While I knew that I'm supposed to be sitting there, that she knows that I'm there and stuff like that, I felt like an intruder. I felt like I was a peeping Tom through the window or something.
Mm-hmm.
That was not a comfortable process for me either. No bells and whistles. A few people, you know, did a little crying here and there, got in touch with a few things. I really don't remember any of their stories or anything. Then it came, you know, got to, you know, be a lunch break, and we went and had lunch, and 1 o'clock, it was my turn. So I lay down. I've seen the procedure now, you know, nobody was too embarrassing, and I figured, you know, I can do this, and blah, blah, blah. So I lay there, and I get as cozy as I could with that little tiny-ass blanket, and I was kind of cold, and that was uncomfortable, and I knew that the music was going to be blaring, and of course it was, and that was uncomfortable. So I had several uncomfortable factors going into this thing. And then they start the music and the process begins. So I start my breathing technique. And so I'm breathing at a faster than normal pace and at a deeper than normal pace. And for me, I kind of have an extremist personality. It's like, well, let's get this thing on. I'm not going to, you know, do any half-ass breathing here. I'm going to do some serious deep, fast breathing. So I'm cranking it out and breathing and breathing and breathing and breathing and breathing. And about 10 minutes into the process, I'm wondering, like, you know, really not a whole heck of a lot happening here. But I continue, and all of a sudden my right shoulder just kind of like starts to hurt, and I'm going like, it's uncomfortable, you know, and I'm going like, well, you know, what's that about? And then my right side starts to hurt, and I'm wondering what that's about, but I knew that this must have something to do with some issues or something. That there was at least some information here for me, whatever it meant, whatever this discomfort that was developing was, there was some information here for me. So I kept breathing and breathing and breathing, and sometimes I'd focus my breathing directly into the areas that were hurting. And the next thing that started happening was like when I was in the teachings, all of a sudden, you know, my one hand, I don't remember which one, starts kind of like doing little twitches and twerks and slight movements, and then the next one, and then different components of my body while I'm laying, they just start doing these little twitchings and these little movements, and then the little movements became not so little. It in some cases I could it was like exercising, a full-on no-nonsense exercise. I remember one component was like all of a sudden like I was riding a bicycle and I was just pedaling and pedaling and pedaling, and I kept pedaling, and I'm holding my legs and I'm going, shit, man, I'm tired and this hurts, but yet I couldn't stop the pedaling. You know, it kept going, and it just finally it got to the point where, and this happened with different parts of my body over the next hour, I would exercise it or move it so much that I literally depleted the muscle and could barely move that muscle at all. I mean, just barely move it at all. And at this point, I was just, you know, I went from being cold, I was soaked in sweat. You know, the blanket was off of me, and some of my movements were very meditative. as in as if I was working on areas of my chakras, along my, you know, the front of my body, different areas of my body, my arms, my elbows, my head. Some of it was very meditative, and it was almost, what would I call it? It was almost like prayerful, like I was doing a physical prayer. And I was doing like a sacred geometry on my body. This is after I had gotten over the rougher portion, the exercise kind of movements. And sometimes I would go back to the exercise thing, and other times, you know, and I would be sitting up. It looked like, if you've ever seen voodoo dancers, they're like in a trance. Well, some of my movements were like that, except that I was staying in place. That was one of the rules. We had to contain ourselves, stay in place, whatever we do, because we could crash into other people, blah, blah, blah. And so this process went on. I was exhausted. I was soaked, and yet I kept moving. At this point, I'm going to have to start referring to my notes here.
Okay.
One of the things that I realized with one of the main purposes of this movement was that in it took so much energy to do these things and these movements that I was doing that I was reaching a state of physical exhaustion, but I continued my breathing, and that the reason that I was doing that, it necessitated my using up a lot of my own energy so that I could drop the barriers to the information that would be forthcoming. Again, this is a retrospective view now. I didn't know that was going on at the time. I was just kind of like in the middle of doing something. You know, my body just insisted on doing these things, so I kept doing it. But it was to use up and burn up energy so that I could put down these walls that I have against, you know, to protect myself, you know, these psychological walls or whatever energy walls that we have, so that we don't hear or see or deal with things that would be injurious psychologically or spiritually or even physically to ourselves. Well, my walls came down. You know, kind of like the walls of Jericho, they came down. When the barriers came down, and I can't say that it's like I felt this wall topple. You know, it wasn't like something like that. It was just like all of a sudden, I just didn't have the strength to protect myself from anything. You know, that I realized. It was just like, boy, I'm here, I'm raw, I'm bare, I'm vulnerable, and that's where I am. Then I started crying. And I start crying, and I start crying. I'm not really in touch with why I'm crying. I don't know what's going on. But I keep my breathing and I keep my crying. And one of the things that I did when I was doing through all that movement, which kind of stood out, was I assumed what I would consider to be a birthing position for a woman. It's like I was on my back, my legs were spread, and it was like my arms were coming down from the top of my body, pushing down my belly as if I wanted to expel an energy baby or something, you know? And I'm thinking, this is bizarre, you know? And I keep putting my hands down. It's like, and I mean, I'm tight and I'm pushing down, I'm grunting. I'm trying to expel something. You know, and I keep doing these movements and doing these movements, and finally that stops. And so I start this crying and and I'm wondering, like, you know, okay, maybe I had the baby or something, you know, and I'm crying, and but I'm not really clear on why the heck I'm crying. You know, I just know I'm crying. And the crying starts to deepen and get worse. It's like, now I'm hurting and I'm crying. And I'm confused. I don't know what's going on. And I need to look at my record.
Go ahead.
And then it's like I went into this deep state of grieving all of a sudden. I'm screaming. And I still don't know what's going on. I'm screaming. I was worse than anything I saw on that tape that I thought was embarrassing and blah, blah, blah. But when I was into this thing, I wasn't thinking about any tape, you know. That whole embarrassment thing was gone. And I am just screaming. And this pain. This pain in my heart was horrible. Just absolutely horrible. And as the intensity of that pain continued to magnify, all of a sudden I started thinking about the friends and the acquaintances that were killed in Vietnam. And it's like I come to the realization I never grieved for these people. Not a once had I ever thought of grieving about their loss. And all of a sudden, this pain just magnifies. It's like every time I think, okay, this is really bad. This is really painful, but it's bottomed out. You know, this is as bad as it gets. Boy, was I wrong. It's like I read this sci-fi book. It was a time travel book. And it talked about warping space and time. And in this one little scene, they'd already come back, you know, this future people came back and got this guy who was also a time traveler and got him because he'd been stranded in time. And they get into, you know, he's walking into this little ship. And he steps inside this little ship, and it's huge. Inside, it's just huge. Hundreds of people working at different things. And from the outside, it looks like a ship that would accommodate no more than two or three people. You know, a little shuttle.
Right.
And when one of the people who came back to get this guy said, well, you know, if we can warp a time, we can also warp space, you know? And so I guess the outside was very deceiving because the inside could have been a mile wide or something like that. I use that as a way of describing this pain and this grieving and the tentacles to which that I had to follow in this thing. It went to, it was all inside of me, but it was yet, it was like space was warped because this was so huge and I went so deep into this thing and I'm just a little guy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Where is all this space inside of me? It was tremendous. It could have been miles wide or bigger for all I know. All I know was that I was now on a journey of pursuing the pain of grieving. And it hurt. It hurt so bad. So it's all I can say. And I didn't think that my heart contained the pain anymore. And yet, that was only one level. This went even deeper. So, I started thinking about all these people that had died over there. Friends of mine that I never grieved about, and just people that I knew, and I didn't even have to know them. It was just like, this was my fellow soldier, or my fellow Marine, or my fellow Air Force person, or Naval person, or this and that. This person is here to support and help protect me, and I'm here to help protect them. And now they're dead. And that hurts.
Do you need to take a break?
I don't know. I don't want to.
Okay.
Want to take a break. I just need to cry when I need to cry.
Okay. This must have been surprising for you.
Yes, it was. I had no idea. I had no idea. This was out of the clear blue sky. So here I'm feeling the pain of grieving and the pain of loss. And okay, this is something that I the closest I even came to that was a little ice squirt when I found out that my squad leader, who, you know, I'm kind of ashamed to say that I don't even remember his name anymore. He and I became kind of good friends. He was the first one to be killed, coming out of the chopper on that day that I was shot twice in that rice paddy.
Yeah.
And when I heard, when one of the other guys, we were under fire, and I don't know how he just, you know, Corporal so-and-so has been killed, it's just like, I just took a moment to absorb that, and I started crying. And I just did a little crying because, you know, I was knee-deep in the middle of a battle, and I didn't have time to cry. So that was it. That was the extent to which I grieved for anybody, if I grieved for anybody at all, prior to this particular experience. So here I'm thinking about... one thought, and then I'd have another thought that had no connection whatsoever with his first thought. There was no linear progression to any of these thoughts. They were just random thoughts that would come in about an assortment of different things. But when I started this particular process, one of the things that I realized that it became very linear. One thing that made sense just came in right after the next thing that made sense, that tied into the next thing, that made sense, that tied into the next thing. And it was all very beautiful, actually. When I got in touch with the fact that, you know, I had lost these friends, others had been hurt, some had been hurt, and all of a sudden they were gone, and, you know, they were back in the world in the hospital. And I just, you know, a few minutes ago I had a friend here. Next thing I know, my friend is hurt. The next thing I know, my friend is gone, you know, and I don't see or hear from him anymore. And that was painful. I got in touch with all of that. Where the hell am I here? And then it's like I got in touch with that. I had not grieved for these people. Okay, that became clear. And the next thing that happened is I started thinking about myself. I'm looking at my notes here, just a second. And
sure.
Right now I'm talking about line 13 and line 14, line 12. when I assumed the birthing position, I tried to expel the energy baby. It says page 274. You know what? I think I told myself that I wanted to read page 274.
Okay.
On my notes. So I think I'm going to do that right now.
Okay.
Part of the irony was that I again remembered watching the people on the video do what I thought were kind of stupid or embarrassing things that I couldn't relate to doing myself. After hyperventilating, my inhibitions were quickly gone, and I was doing everything that those people were doing and many motions beyond. But I had no time to consider being embarrassed. This went on for a while until I assumed a birthing-like position, imagining myself as a woman giving birth. I was on my back, slightly lifted, arching back in the air with hand motions. I was moving energy down my body as if trying to expel the baby. The process continued, and at one point I started thinking I made a transition from a somatic experience to an intellectual one. I was having a variety of separate thought processes that were not connected. They were of an eclectic nature. Nothing was joined. It was all separate stuff, an abundance of different thoughts and memories. I started thinking about my experience in Vietnam. In retrospect, one of the things that I finally really find really fascinating about this was that these thought processes were now linear in nature, whereas prior to the thought processes, the prior thought processes were not linear at all. They were disjointed. They were anything that came up at any point in time, having nothing whatsoever to do with the thought prior, just prior to or following. But then my thought processes became linear. It started with my feeling bad about my participation in the war and seeing the M16s and the tanks. This had become seeing the M16s and the tanks. Anytime I went into meditation, that memories of Vietnam came up, almost invariably, the first things I would start saying is a floating M16s in some fog or something. And sometimes I would see tanks or other weaponry. And other artifacts of war, and some thoughts about some of the murders and other atrocious behavior that I had committed over there. I got in touch with my usual feelings, attitude, remembrances, and perceptions, where I was feeling sorry that I had participated in those things and feeling guilty about the destruction and the murders. I was not having any kind of new level of contact internally, nor any new information or insight. At this point, I began a profoundly deep crying. That's an understatement. The crying deepened and continued getting deeper until I entered a level of grieving that I have never before experienced. I had grieved little before this, only once during the war. And that's when I talked about I was in the midst of that battle, and I just told you about it a couple of times. Lying there breathing, I was beginning to get in touch with the grief that I had never expressed or released. The pain surfaced, and I started crying in grief as if I had never before. Getting in touch with the loss of my friend at a level I had never allowed myself to until now. And little did I know I was about to enter realms of grief that I can't even imagine. My first breathing soon became fits of painful screaming, so loud it drowned out the music. And that music was loud. I mean, you have to understand, the music was loud, and I was able to drown it out. It had surfaced. It was all pervasive. It was in my consciousness, and all I could do was scream and cry incessantly. Thoughts prevailed, and while I was screaming and crying, I started thinking about these thoughts, that were still coming to me. From the point where I started grieving about my friends, I also began to think about me. I'm not sure why I put down that I wanted to read this. But anyway, this brings us to where I was about to say that I entered that I got in touch that I had not grieved about my friends, and right then and there went into deep grieving for their loss. And then when I became aware that that was a level that I hadn't gone to, all of a sudden my consciousness changed and I went into yet a deeper level. You know, I can throw the word deep and deeper from now till hell freezes, but I'm talking about a process that transpired and how it is possible to go from this level of incredible deep pain that seems insurmountable and yet go into a deeper, more painful one I have limited ability to describe that, maybe none at all. All I can tell you is every time I had a consciousness expansion in a level that I was participating in, I moved on to the next, not knowing what the next was. It's just like this next picture appeared before me, and it was, I haven't even looked at this before, and I would go into just deeper pain. The name of the game was pain. And before I continue with this, I have always said that I am a story of hope. I don't want to scare anybody away from a journey that they may need to make. Because first of all, their journey will be different than mine. Mine was mine, theirs will be theirs. It may encompass little pain or it may encompass a lot of pain. If you want to heal, you need to make the journey. I don't know any way around that. Fortunately for me, I didn't know what the journey was, and I doubt if for you, you will either. It's just a process will begin, and you're off and running.
But you have to make a choice to do that healing, correct?
Yeah, you have to make the choice to do the healing. And you know, I did a lot of prayers on my way down there and talked to God and talked to my guru and talked to angels. And I talked to whoever would listen, and I'm sure that was all of them. And just ask them for self-help. I told them I wanted to know. You know, I wanted to know. I needed to resolve. And this is how it played out. So I guess what I'm saying is I don't want to scare you from this. I'm talking about levels of pain that the average person, their heels are smoking in the distance when they've heard about this and they're gone. And I guess this is not for them, but it's going to be for somebody out there who is hurting enough to say, I want to heal and I'm willing to do whatever it takes.
Okay.
And so I wanted to preface that. As soon as I realized that I had not grieved for my friends, I entered this other level of awareness. I had not grieved for me. I had not thought about me at all. It was like I was barely 18, and here I was in this incredible predicament, these things I'd gotten myself into. I didn't know how to handle them. I wasn't prepared for them. I did the best I could under the circumstances. That was on my first tour. My second tour, you know, I was a little older, but not much wiser. And I did the best I could over there to try and stay alive, to try and keep my people alive, and to try and minimize the damage that I inflicted on the villages and on the people to the degree that I could. But it wasn't anywhere near enough. And I focused on me and what a young man I was and what a hell of a predicament I found myself in and how sorry I was for me that I had managed to fuck up my life so much that this is where it took me. And how much regret I had for the pain and sorrow that I had inflicted on myself and on my family for knowing that I was over there. And that was a level of consciousness unto itself. And when I became aware of that, I just hurt even more for me. And I guess it could be considered a poor me, but, you know, I don't give a fuck. It was like I had never thought about it and what a mess I had made of my life. And what a mess I had made of other people's lives. And I hurt. I hurt for that. My pain was specific to that, and it was a deeper, more expansive pain. And I'm going, is there no end to this? I can't hurt anymore. I felt like my heart was going to explode. And as I came to that awareness, things changed again. I went to another level. And this time it was before the Vietnamese people. It's like I told myself, my God, what have I done? What have I done? The death and destruction that I've rendered on that society. And the pain got deeper. And I hurt more. And I thought I was going to die. I was at a point where I've welcomed death. I just didn't want to hurt anymore.
So this was a releasing process.
This is a major purge. And it's like I kept following these tentacles of pain deeper into my being and deeper into my being, and there seemed to be no end to it. How deep can this go? And I just could see the destroyed villages. The dead people, and the dead animals, and just the havoc that I brought upon that nation. And I went, it's just like when that realization came, it's like that picture was lost, and there was this fog. And in that fog, it was like I was back in that rice paddy where I'd been shot. And this Vietnamese soldier comes out of the woods. And he had been the sniper that shot me. And he walked up to me, and we didn't verbalize. This was all telepathy. You know, and that's the other thing. It was like prior to this whole fog thing, it was like I could feel the feelings of the Vietnamese. I could feel their pain. I could feel their sorrow.
You're talking about the whole country?
When I was thinking about, you know, prior to the fog thing and this soldier coming out of the forest, that was another connection with that experience. I could feel that stuff. I could feel how they felt for the loss of their loved ones and the destruction of their village. I could feel their hate for us. I just felt so many things. And then the fog, and then the soldier comes out of the fog, and he's the one that had shot me. And I realized that this guy was just a regular guy, you know. He could have been a teacher, or he could have been, you know, just a farmer, a rice farmer, or he's just a regular guy. I could feel that he, you know, he wasn't going to tolerate and accept our invasion of his country. He wasn't going to accept the destruction we were bringing into it by, for whatever reasons, for what, by whatever name we called it. He was not accepting of it, and he was going to fight us. And that's all there was to it. The day that I was shot twice, that second time around, you know, he was such a good shot. I know that when that medic picked me up and we started walking away, I know, I just, every fiber in my being tells me that guy could have easily put it right in the center of both of our backs. No problems. He was good. Instead, he chose to shoot us in the leg. I think he was touched by God. I think that God did not want me dead that day. I had things to do. And so he touched him, and he couldn't not shoot because we're the invaders. But he also could no longer put it right in the middle of our backs, which he could have easily. So he had to fight us. And so here we were, and I was just telling him how incredibly sorry I was for the things that I had done. I just told him I didn't know what I was doing. I just didn't know what I was doing. I asked for his forgiveness, and he gave it to me. And it was just like, okay, it's time to leave, you know. And that was not painful. That asking for the forgiveness and receiving it, I felt better about that. And it's like he turned around and walked back into the woods, and the fog came in, and I lost the picture. And I'm going to have to jump to my notes again.
Okay.
I think so. This is actually difficult to do with paperwork because I really wish I could have just remembered it and flowed.
Sure.
I think about the Vietnamese people. Okay. Journey even deeper into pain. The emotional pain was truly overwhelming. I don't know how I was going to live with the pain I was experiencing. Unfortunately, I didn't have time to think about it very much because things were unfolding rapidly. I believe God was helping me to continue to experience a profound empathy with the Vietnamese people, apologizing to them. Okay, it's a little... It just broke. Oh, okay. Here we go. This was the next step that I was looking for. As soon as I had that conversation with that soldier, he walked back into the woods, back into the fog. All of a sudden, what I saw was an M16 again, bam, broken in half. seems like the pain just started to lighten up and lighten up. Let me see what I put down here. I knew the significance of the broken rifle, and a burden lifted. And I felt the freedom as the deep pain all of a sudden ended. The pain no longer existed. The journey was shifting, and I found myself both crying very deeply and at the same time laughing. Oh, yeah, I remember that. Boy, I sounded like an absolute madman. I would cry and scream, and I would stop and laugh right in the middle of that crying. It's almost like I had lost it. It was kind of like I lost it. But I was feeling this profound sense of relief, so to speak. Just somehow the significance of that broken rifle meant that no more. No more. This is it. I'm done. Not just here and now and in this lifetime, but for all lifetimes. This military streak, this warrior streak that has existed for so long is broken, just like that rifle is broken. And I'm not doing this anymore. Crying and laughing, it seemed that I was a madman. I remember to say, and that's when I said to myself, it seems to me I seem to preface everything with these wows, you know. Mm-hmm. When I felt that calmness over my heart, I said, wow, I really do feel better about this. When I was dying in the rice paddy, I said, wow, I'm dying. Here's another wow. All these wows were pretty big wows, you know, profound wows. I said to myself, wow, I'm healed. Now, I cannot explain the profound relief and joy that I experienced. I knew that the journey of the pain was over. I had seared that pain. I had burned it. I had walked through it. I had let it char my psyche and my soul. And all of a sudden, it was like a phoenix was born. I was through it. And so I said, wow, I'm healed. And right then and there, I heard a voice say, bring some veterans with you. Either God or one of his emissaries wanted me to know that, okay, you've done this journey, and now there are others that need the help. And you are some kind of an instrument to that purpose. Bring some veterans with you. If I ever get this book written, I'm going to title it, Bring Some Veterans With You. And I started crying. Not that I ever necessarily stopped, but now I was just crying. It was a happy cry. I don't do less than five happy cries in my life, all of which have been in my adult years. It was like this happy cry and this profound relief and this joy. And not to mention that I just had God talk to me. God never verbalizes things to me. He helps me all he can. But he never verbalizes things to me. And here, this day, he talked to me. Simple little sentence, but a big one. And, you know, okay, where am I? I had no... wow, I'm here. I knew this was the final level. The final level was grieving for my comrades who went down, whom I had no time to grieve for, grieving for myself as a young man, a mere boy in a horrible situation. give it grieving for the Vietnamese people, grieving for the American people. Mutual forgiving between the sniper and myself. As soon as I proclaimed to myself, wow, I'm healed, I heard the voice, bring some prisoners with you. And I don't know how to describe it. It was a voice that sounded like my voice, but it wasn't speaking the words. They were not my words. If I wasn't speaking those words, it was not my words. If I were asked to say where these words or those words or voice came from, if I were to name a particular location, it was from the center of my brain. I mean, it's almost like, to the centimeter in the center of my brain, that voice just spoke. The words came right from the middle of my brain. I've never experienced anything like it. That's what I wrote. And as soon as that happened, the picture changed again on me. And all of a sudden, I'm seeing like this ticker tape parade down Wall Street in New York, whatever it is.
Down Fifth Avenue?
Down Fifth Avenue, uh-huh. Ticker tape parade, graffiti flying everywhere. It was the World War I Doughboys coming home, and I was looking at this picture, and then all of a sudden it dawned on me that I was welcoming myself home. I was welcoming the Vietnam veterans home. I was experiencing a grateful nation. And I just, this was not a painful thing, but it was a joyous thing. It was like, I have both been forgiven, and now I am welcoming me home, and I'm welcoming my fellow vets home, and the nation is healed, and they're welcoming us home, you know, and we are one, you know, we are one in this experience. And I started crying. And from there, things started to settle down and settle down. And I started coming out of the whole thing. And I knew as soon as external consciousness started to come back to me, awareness of my environment and where I was in and whatnot, I knew that I really, really needed to hold Leslie's hand. And I asked her if she would hold my hand, and she did. And I felt imbalanced. Something was wrong, and I realized that I needed to be holding on to the hand of a woman, but I also needed to be holding on to the hand of a man. So I asked her to ask David if he would hold my other hand, and David came over, and he did. And I held her hands for about 20 minutes as I lay there, and I realized that the imbalance that I had experienced was because I don't have any problems being open and close with a woman, but I have serious problems being open and close with a man, probably with the exception of my son and my brother.
Mm-hmm.
And that I have serious man issues. I looked upon men as the Antichrist, as the destructors of all things on earth. You know, if there's anybody who's willing to kill and plunder and rape and murder and just do the most heinous things on this planet, almost invariably it's the men. And I, you know, it's a realization that I just hated them. I just hated them. I even to this moment want to say the word hate and bring it into the present. I won't allow myself. That I just don't trust them, and that there's such an evil force. And yet, I was realizing that this is half of humanity, and they are my brothers, and they are the brothers that I was in Vietnam with. And that there's goodness and love in their heart. And that it's a matter of tapping this source of energy and love, and helping men come forth and be the gentle, loving beings that is innate within them and that they can get in touch with. And in conversely, to be able to do that with myself. That's why I felt that imbalance, and that's why to this day I'm still struggling with issues with men. But I've come a long way there too. And when I started to settle down from these thought processes and this experience, the next thought, when I say that this is all very linear, I mean it was all very linear, you know, the next thought process I realized was that, God, I've been armed for 24 and a half years. I have a fucking arsenal of weaponry at home, and I've been armed since the Marine Corps. As a matter of fact, I had a zip gun and a 22 when I was a kid, so I possessed weaponry for more than 30 years, and that's over half of my lifetime. I've been, you know, kind of like buckled down and just ready to take on whatever may come. And all of a sudden, the voice again saying, you have 24 hours to destroy your weapons. And it's like, wow, okay. Gee, that's no small task. Not to mention that at the time, anyway, we're talking about maybe $5,000 worth of weaponry.
Wow.
You know, by today's value, they'd be a lot, more, 2 or 3 times that much. And I'm going, okay, all right, I can do this, I'm sure. You know, and this connection of that I've been armed and protecting myself for so many incredible years. So, things kind of lightened up and kind of, you know, and then we got up and when I tried to sit up, I was exhausted. I was so exhausted. I had no idea that somebody could be that exhausted. My energies were depleted. I could barely sit up without help. My voice was just totally hoarse. I had screamed so much that I was kind of talking like this or something. You know, it was just, my throat was inflamed. I was this wet noodle of a human being, and a deep, deep, deep exhaustion, and at the same time, a deep sense of well-being and mission accomplished. I literally had walked to the shadow of the valley of death. And I came out the other side. And I'm pretty damn proud of myself.
You went through quite a bit.
Yeah.
And this is in November of 1994.
Yeah. Yeah. So
did you get to the weapons?
Well, I'm about to get there.
Okay.
So, you know, people helped me up, and I got some water, and then we kind of sat around and kind of shared our tales and our stories. And Kit and Rush told me that had been the heaviest experience they had undergone in this holotropic breathing at that point in time. Certainly was mine. So I go home, and I confront, well, let me see. So Jadida is home, her boyfriend, what's his name? I can't remember his name right this second. But he's home too, and I really wanted to share this story with Jadida, but there was this reticence to share it with, I'll call him Mark for now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I focused and said, wait a minute, you know, why is it okay to share it with Jadida, but not with Mark? I said, this is absurd. This is part of that, you know, anti-male,
mm-hmm.
anti-male separation thing that I have. So I said, I'll just share it with both of them, and I did. And, you know, their kind of jaws were a bit hanging by the time the whole process was done. And so I kind of was very, very pensive, retroflective for the rest of the day. And I was crying on and off every time I thought about what had happened that morning. And that night I went to bed thinking about it. And I woke up early the next morning thinking about it. And I realized that, you know, I tried to, you know, put the time component together. You know, it was like I had till maybe 1 or 2 o'clock that day my 24 hours would be up, and I was kind of keeping track of it. And I had this metal chop saw in my garage, and some of those guns that I had were even just like collector's guns, you know, kind of cool old-time single-shot pistols and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going like, you know, I guess I could sell them, you know, but I can't do it quick enough. You know, 24 hours would be up pretty quick. I can't sell these things. And besides, I just can't put these things back out on the street. You know, they're designed for taking life, and I can't put them back on the street. So I was stuck with the decision, you know, destroy them. And I took it down to about the 23rd hour. And then I went to the garage, took all of them, laid them all out. Didn't know how hard a time I was going to have with the chop saw. And it was just like, zoom. I put them on the chop saw and went zoom, zoom. I had no problems whatsoever destroying any of them. Even that little collector gun at the end, I looked at it for a second and went, ah, fuck this. Zoom, zoom, zoom. I destroyed those things. It was amazingly simple for me to destroy them all. Amazingly simple. Jadida stood there taking pictures, and I have no idea what happened to those pictures. I think they were lost. That was unfortunate. But that was my third healing. It was a doozy in my life. You know, that said, let me say also that I've had little healings since then, other awarenesses that I've had to deal with. But still, overall, and the whole conversation when I first got together with my former friends from VVAW, which was about May of 2005, after about 30 years that I hadn't seen these people, you know, just through some experiences that we had. Well, the whole Texas Tech thing.
Yeah.
That's when I was reintroduced to them. The whole, you know, I had been walking around saying that I'm a healed veteran. Yet I never really defined for myself or for another what that really meant, because when I think about some of the things that I did over there or saw or allowed to happen or happen under my command, you know, I still cry about that. I guess what I mean now by healing, and this is probably repetitious because I think I've said it before, but I'll say it again because it's worth hearing, is that it's not that I don't feel this, it's not that when I think of these things, I don't necessarily cry. Sometimes I do and sometimes I don't. Before, it was like invariably I would cry. But now the difference is that when I cry, it's not, it's like a, it's about a sadness. You know, it's about a sadness.
I could pick that up.
Before, it was anguish that I had done these things. There was no forgiveness of self involved. There was no forgiveness of others. I will probably always cry when I think about these things because it was a sad chapter of my life. But I will always be happy about the fact that it was a liberating component of my life and that they both go together. So I say that I'm healed because the anguish and the sorrow and that, oh, so horrible, beautiful pain is no longer there associated with it. Now it's just plain sadness. So I still say I'm a healed veteran. You know, I'll say it to whomever, wherever. And I'll also say that I did it. I am not an unusual guy. I am not a Superman. I'm just a guy who wanted out and didn't want to put a gun to his head to get that outness. I didn't want to drown myself in drugs, though I did for a little while, to stop the pain. I wanted to do it another way, and I didn't know what that other way was. And I stumbled through my, I can't even say I found my path. I stumbled through my path on a day-to-day basis. And then when I look back, I could see the path now that I walked. It's doable. You know, it's doable. But you've really got to want it. So,
why don't you think some veterans don't want to go there and do that?
You know, I think it's that pain. Man, that pain is so searing. It's so overwhelming and incompetent. I thought my heart was going to implode when that whole thing was going on. It was like this black hole, this vortex that had this long, long extension to it. And like, where the fuck is the end? When does it stop? I can't take much more. You know? And when a human being is confronted with something like that and no answer while the process is going on, that can be a dangerous moment in their life, you know? That it's really, really easy, really possible to take a gun to your head at that point. You know, I didn't think of the gun in my head at that point. I've thought of the gun in my head many, many times before that. I've even thought of it a few times since then based on other issues. It's a beautiful moment and it's a dangerous moment and I don't know that sooner or later they're going to have to face it. When I say sooner or later, I don't necessarily mean in this lifetime. But they take that stuff to the grave with them. It's got to be resolved. It's energy. It follows, you know. And we like to think, hey, we're going up to paradise. You know, the whole Christian thing. We're going up to paradise and blah blah blah. You know, it's cosmic forever and. I don't think so. I do not think so. I think you got to resolve these things, and we'll get yet another opportunity to resolve it. So that's why I say that I'm done with wars in this lifetime. I'm not done with violence in my beingness completely. You know, it's like even Jesus, I think his last act of violence, recorded violence, was the toppling of the moneylenders' table and stuff like that in the synagogue type of thing, and I think he walked away from that and realized his error, and you never hear of another act of violence from Jesus. I've had experiences recently that have brought forth unknowingness to me that I still have violence in my being, that I can still perpetuate violence on another. And that is both sad, and I don't like it. And I know that I'm not complete. I just know that I am complete with taking that violence, putting it into an organized manner, and applying it to a foreign culture or even to our own culture. You know, from that component is done for this lifetime and all the rest to come. Now I just need to, these last steps of getting, you know, wanting to punch somebody out. You know, I don't think, maybe he did, I don't know, but Jesus never punched anybody out. You know, Buddha never punched anybody out. And Calixto doesn't want to punch anybody out, but he has the propensity still to do that.
Yeah.
And so I've got healing and growth to do.
Well, most people still do. You know, I don't know if you're ever going to reach that point.
Yeah, it's the human condition. It is the human condition. But that is the beauty and the marvel of somebody like Jesus and Buddha. And I think Mohammed, I really don't know a whole lot about Mohammed. That these are beings, they were born into flesh, they walked the earth, they had all the temptations that we have nowadays, different, but all the temptations, including the desire to punch somebody's lights out because they piss you off,
mm-hmm.
you know, and somehow, maybe they did their own purge like I did with this whole healing thing, maybe they went, journeyed into themselves and found all of these misconceptions or shortcomings, or maybe even they found something like that thing in my second healing, you know, that existed within them.
Mm-hmm.
They managed to purge all of that, clear themselves out, and literally walked on water, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're saying, what their teaching has always been, is it's doable. These things I do, you too can do and more. And that's my belief. And that's, by golly, where I'm going.
That's a powerful message.
Yeah. I don't know if I'll make it in this lifetime, but I know that I'm not too many lifetimes off anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I just have a deep sense of knowing this, that I'm not too many lifetimes off anymore.
Why don't we stop for today?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.